Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. Joining me today is award-winning short story writer and poet John O'Donnell, whose latest collection, Mr. Who and Other Stories, is out now with Dara Press. I began by asking him if he remembered his early reading days. Can I bring you back now to your childhood and to, I suppose, your first discovery of reading, of books, if it happened as a child or if it happened later on?
I mean, I remember, obviously, I don't remember being very young, like reading stuff under the age of 4 or 5. I don't remember that. But I remember in kind of probably primary school when I was 7 or 8, I was a bit young, just starting in primary school. But they were encouraging us, the school I was in was encouraging us to read books like Rosemary Sutcliffe's books and The Chronicles of Narnia and those kind of books. And I have no criticism of them, but they really didn't interest me. What I was interested in was Enid Blyton. And, you know, I know subsequently Enid Blyton is a very questionable figure in children's literature, and some wonderful kind of TV presentations of her. I think I've seen one or two of them. Helena Bonham Carter, I think, played her in one. But anyway, but never mind that. She wrote brilliant books about kids. She had The Famous Five, The Secret Seven. My own favourite were the Five Find-Outers and Dog, as you recall, because there was a dog called Buster. And I devoured those. I would be getting them. My mother would constantly be trying to keep me supplied with those, like food. And I loved them. And they weren't, I'm not saying they had any great merit, but they were great stories. I really enjoyed the stories. Now, again, they had some questionable characters in them. I mean, one of the kids in the Five Find-Outers was a bit plump and his name was Fatty. I mean, you know, you wouldn't put that in a children's book. You'd be doubtful whether you'd put it in an adult's book now, but certainly in a children's book, the idea that he would be called Fatty. I should also say that in one of the books she wrote, which I did kind of turn me off her a little bit, she had a book called Six Bad Boys, where these kids get into trouble, but the only one who is the really troublesome one, and she says at the end, will remain troublesome, and this is the guy who's never going to be good again, and he was an Irish boy called Patrick. So, you know, that kind of incipient racism that we saw in Noddy and Toyland and so on, and the Gollywogs, that was kind of apparent in that book as well. But I still, you know, so between the ages of kind of 7 and 12 or 13, I was, or say certainly 12, I thought that, you know, I loved those books. And despite my teachers kind of frowning about them and, you know, trying to dissuade us, I ate them up.
You loved them. And John, were you writing at all at this point, or were you dabbling in anything?
I really, this sounds very nerdy, but I enjoyed English. English was my favourite subject. And the thing I most enjoyed in English was writing stories. When you would be set one, I wouldn't necessarily write one on my own, but when I was set a story to write, I would really, really engage with it and enjoy it and try. And I loved making up those kind of worlds. So as far back as primary and early secondary school, I was doing that when I was told to do it, and I enjoyed doing it. Yeah.
Yes. And would you say you were studious? And did you have, like you say, English was your favourite subject? Were you interested in other things? Were you also interested in science or math?
No, I wasn't. I was and am, and I suspect always will be, useless at maths. Absolutely hopeless. A big mistake I made was to try and do honours maths, because at that stage it gave you honours points, a little bit like gives you enhanced points now for the Leaving Cert. Mm. And it was just a complete mistake, because I was spending far too much time on it and it wasn't going in. I couldn't, you know, it might as well have been in Sanskrit for all that I could make out of it. So, you know, I kind of, you know, history I liked, and I the school that I was in, they taught Latin, and I learned Greek briefly.
Oh, wow. But,
yeah.
You went into secondary school then for this. So Latin and Greek, wow, really formative things to learn.
Yeah, I mean, particularly Latin. I mean, I think when you have to make your choices for the Leaving Cert, I abandoned Greek. So I only took Greek for about 3 years. or learned Greek. But I mean, it was still interesting. And obviously, what I was interested in was the history and the stories, you know, the Iliad, the Odyssey,
yes,
that kind of stuff. And that was interesting. But Latin is, you know, you learned a lot about the sources of words. You learned that from Greek as well. But,
yeah,
but
of course. About
the sources of words. You become quite good at spelling. Some of the grammar was still pretty demanding, but that certainly was interesting and informative.
And so did that give you a sort of interest in etymology then, or just naturally a sort of osmosis of etymology?
I think you have something in there anyway, but it certainly helped it and enhanced it and helped me to kind of to grow it in some way.
Yes, you can sort of see into words just in a different way.
Yeah, and where they come from. And like, I'd still be interested in knowing where a phrase comes from or where a word comes from. And you'll often find that there is a Latin root to it, or a Greek root.
And were you reading, like, it sounds quite, were you reading advanced texts like Homer?
No. I mean, that makes it sound incredibly pretentious. But I mean, when I would have been 12, 13, 14, we would have been learning about them and then doing things like the alphabet.
Okay, Amoamasamat, yes.
You know, and there was lots of, you know, the soldiers, the tables, you know, all they were very, very basic. But you still got the kind of the source of a lot of the words. You know, agriculture, Agricola as a farmer, I still remember that. I don't know why, I'm not a farmer, but, you know.
Yes, and I was going to ask you, do you think, I mean, that's sort of kind of dying out from the curricula all over the place, like, and in third level as well, you know, sure, studying, you know, ancient languages or ancient history is gone.
I think some of the Greek faculties, and they may have closed some of them, so maybe in Northern Ireland, I think they were talking about closing off Greek, yeah. I mean, very few people studied it in Ireland, and, like, the school I was in was kind of sneered at by, you know, other schools for, you know, Greek. What was the benefit of it? But it certainly, I suppose, a little bit like Latin, and not so many people laugh at Latin as at Greek, but again, it gave you a basis of where words come from, so that 20 years later you might say, oh, there's a Greek word a bit like that, you know, that you might remember, and that certainly helps.
I would like to know what you were like as a teenager, because I'm sort of getting the sort of surface picture here. What kind of adolescent were you?
I'm sure I was the bog standard, awkward, tricky handful. I mean, I did enjoy, because I went to a school which played rugby, albeit played it, you know, didn't have any great success. I did enjoy it. I wasn't necessarily any good at it, but I did enjoy it, and I played it a lot. I played it in school and I played it in college and so on. So I did enjoy that. I did study a lot for English, and I was reasonably good at it in my class, and likewise history. And again, writing narratives was something that I enjoyed, you know, readings and finding out why things happened. Less so in science, and even less so, as I say, in mathematics.
So what sort of, were you reading? Were you reading mostly non-fiction then, or were you?
No, all fiction. And I mean, it's still to this day, I read almost exclusively fiction. I read very little non-fiction. I'm in a book club where occasionally we pick non-fiction, but it's mainly fiction. And given my choice, I would read fiction pretty much every time. I just like that idea of being in another world and, you know, the writer creating that world around me. So what are the books that I was reading when I was kind of that age? You know, I mean, I still remember the impact of To Kill a Mockingbird. We had a really good English teacher, Tom O'Dea, and a visiting American teacher, Miss Bimstein, a wonderful name. And they taught us To Kill a Mockingbird. And I still remember that, you know, those classes. And that book I still find it very moving to see the movie. I saw, there's a play of it, which is, I saw recently. And obviously you can read the book again and again. And I still find it and thrilling to read. And also, of course, it's set in a sense around a lawyer and a court case. And that was obviously, I'm not saying that made me want to become a lawyer of court case. But, you know, I mean, Atticus Finch is the daddy of all daddies, but he's also in some senses the daddy of all lawyers, you know, so.
Interesting. So when did that start to appeal to you, the idea of studying law, or did it at
well,
school?
No, it did. I mean, I think that was fairly certain by the time I was leaving school that that's what I wanted to do, that I wanted to do law. I kind of wasn't sure about medicine, thought about it, but I thought I wanted to do law and that probably I would want to be a barrister. I'd want, insofar as I knew anything. My mother had practiced at the bar for a few years, which again would have been something of a rarity. There weren't that many women in the bar in the 1970s in Ireland.
Oh my goodness, no, there were not.
Yeah, so she had kind of an insight into how it worked, and I just kind of said, yeah, without really knowing all the kind of details, I said, well, that sounds like the kind of thing that I'd like to do.
And what was it that sounded like the thing you wanted to do? What was it that drew you? I know your mother was practicing and you had some insight there, but what was it that kind of attracted you to it?
I mean, I suppose, you know, you would say, I mean, from the outside, people say, oh, it's the performance. It's the standing up in court and, listening to the sound of your own voice. And that's obviously a part of it. But a more important part of it is marshalling ideas, marshalling facts, marshalling the bits that matter and don't matter, or that matter to your client and don't matter to your client. And what I never realized and never really thought about until I was in there is how much access being a barrister gives you to stories about the human condition. And, you know, so I'm meeting people every day. They're telling me things, you know, that it's incredibly privileged to hear. You can ask them almost anything. And that's something that I hadn't realized, but that is an incredibly rich part of being a trial lawyer in particular. It's obviously, if you're working in a solicitor's firm and you're working in mergers and acquisitions or tax advice or something like that, it's you know, less immediate. But if you're working as a trial lawyer and you're representing somebody who has been accused of criminal offence or somebody who's involved in a terrible family law dispute or some other kind of road accident or something like that, you learn an awful lot about people.
And there's something that kind of struck me about your writing and your short stories in Mr. Who and other stories is that combination of distance and empathy, which I think you're sort of describing there, that you're empathizing with your clients and you're hearing all of this incredibly personal information, but then you're garnering all of this into a cohesive logic, in a sense, or argument or presentation.
Sure. I mean, again, if I can quote Atticus Finch, insofar as you can quote a fictitious lawyer, he says, you know, at one stage he says something like, if you want to get to know somebody, you have to kind of step into their shoes and walk around a bit. And so, you know, when you meet a client for the first time, you kind of say, well, how could that possibly be true? And then when you understand the background to what's happened and their own personal background, say, well, now I do understand it. So that's my job is now, okay, I understand it. Now I have to persuade a jury or a court or the other side that actually there's more to this than meets the eye, that there is another story here that needs to be told.
So interesting. And so when you started down that path, when you began to study law, what was that like? What was that introduction to everything like?
I mean, you know, it could be overwhelming because you start by effectively being apprenticed to a much more senior barrister. He is your master or she, and I am the devil. It's like, you know, it's a weird kind of phraseology, I know, but a kitchen devil is a knife that does everything. And I suppose the devil here is the very junior barrister who's, you know, the master can send off to do things. But obviously you learn from watching him or her work. He or she can send you some little crumbs from his or her table for you to try and do some work. And a lot of it is hanging around, watching other advocates do, you know, perform in court. You learn how to do it well. You learn how it's done badly. You meeting solicitors. Somebody sends you something. You do it okay. Somebody's sitting in court and they see you doing something and say, "Would you like to do this?" And you know, and that's how it builds up. And it's very hard to. You know, it's not in along straight lines, Ruth. It's not, it's you can't really predict how it's going to work. And you need a lot of luck. You need good health.
And to be able to perform under that pressure, that absolute constant pressure.
You have to keep turning up. You have to, as I say, have good health so that you can perform. And I mean, there's no salary. So you, when you're starting, you know, you might, I mean, in my first year, I think I earned £300, you know, so I was living with my parents and thanks be to God, I was able to do that and they were able to look after me. But it was, you know, terrible. If you were trying to do it, if you're trying to pay for rent and so on, it's miserable.
So in a sense, it's quite exclusionary as well.
Well, it could be. And I mean, what happens, you know, then you, after at it maybe a year or two, you pick up things like lecturing jobs and, you know, bits and pieces like that to help supplement your income while you're developing a practice. But certainly the first 5 or 6 years are very tough, very, very tough.
Wow. And then you're laboring under the expectations of your clients or the hopes and fears of your clients as well. And
yeah, I mean, you're not going to be in huge cases in your first 5 or 6 years.
No,
but they're big to them.
Big, you know, to them,
you're doing
exactly.
A district court case where somebody could get a prison sentence of 24 months. You know, that's a big case.
That is a big case. Mm. Gosh, that's and I mean, I suppose it's no wonder why some, because I'm thinking back to some of the stories in the collection as well, and there, you know, you do. It's not that there's legal cases throughout, but there are the touches on the legal system. It touches on law in some senses in some of the stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the settings of them are, there's usually some of them are set in the aftermath of something that's just happened. So the first, you know, if there's a first person account, like if you think of there's a story in this book called A Shepherdess, and a shepherdess is a woman who, It now appears, you, when we hear her, it appears that she's been linked to the deaths of a number of newborn babies on a maternity ward in the hospital where she worked as a maternity nurse. And if you know, in one sense, you know, as I don't know if inspired is the right word, but I was struck listening to people talking about the Lucy Letby case where everybody said, well, she's guilty and that's it. And there's no explanation for that. And she just is guilty. And actually, it's not all that clear. There is certain, I mean, I'm not saying whether she did it or not, but what you would have to say is that there is, the evidence is somewhat circumstantial, like that she happened to be on duty for each of the nights that one of the nurses died. But I mean, you can, those statistical links are kind of in a sense, can be meaningless. You might also say, well, Liverpool were playing each of the nights that one of those babies died, and therefore it's linked to the fact that Liverpool are playing at home. You know, it's not, it couldn't be. So, you know, anyway, what I'm saying is that sometimes you need to explore this a bit more carefully, and sometimes you need to hear, and not so much hear, but listen to what that person is trying to say. So that's her story, but it starts with her solicitor sitting in, you know, an interview room, and the solicitor saying, how do we explain this? How do we explain all this? And it moves on from there.
Yes, and I think there's also a lovely, you have a way of sort of tapping into kind of a really nice ambiguity about motivation, you know, that even motivations they're not simple. It's not, you know, people always ask, what was the motive? And it's like so complex. And, you know, even like inherited behaviours or behaviors that people don't even realize are inherited or inherent.
Yeah, and you know, there often are, I mean, obviously will be some dreadful cases where, you know, there would be people who are inflamed by drugs or by drink or whatever, or rage. But it's, if you look at those kind of situations, there's usually something in the background that has driven them to that. And I'm not apologizing for that. I'm just saying you need to understand it. And people need to understand it. And that's what I'm trying to do is to, I mean, I'm gratified that you think it's empathetic, but I'm trying to allow people to see and to listen to what some of these people would like to say.
Yes. And throughout that kind of apprenticeship that you were talking to me there about, the 5 or 6 years where this is kind of this non-linear kind of apprenticeship, I imagine you didn't have any time to read anything other than your cases and work and, you know, law books or whatever.
You'd be surprised how much spare time, you know, apprentice lawyers have in their first 5 days. Unlike being in an office where you're in there all the time, you might be sitting around in the law library and you mightn't have any case on that day. But, you know, you have to kind of, I suppose, create the impression of being busy and, you know, looking like you're ready, you're available to do anything, but you're always busy. So, you know, it's a very ambivalent kind of way of conducting yourself. I appreciate that. And also you don't want to, you know, if someone says, are you busy? That could be a trap because they could hand you something that's dreadful and that you've never been paid for and that you've been involved in for days. And, you know, so you have to be very cautious in some respects. And yet you don't want people to think that you're not doing anything. So,
yes, I don't know if you ever watched Seinfeld, but George Costanza has a lovely episode in that where he's trying to look very, very busy all the time, very important, but like that, not get too much work. But anyway, sorry, stupid.
Kind of idea. You know, I'm up to my neck in absolutely nothing, you know?
So, yes, then I suppose you did have time to read fiction around then. And so what kind of things were you reading then as a sort of a young, a lawyer? Can we say lawyer? Is that even what I say? What would I?
Well, heard? Yeah, I mean, like, you know, it's the generic term. In Ireland, we have a split between the barristers who present cases in court and solicitors who traditionally run offices. Now, solicitors can and always have had for over 50 years a full right of audience in all the courts in Ireland. So they are entitled to present cases in court. And some of them do in the district court. And some of them have been made judges and some very fine solicitor judges. But generally speaking, the barrister is the one who you would engage to represent you at a hearing in a court case.
And would you have been called a barrister at that point?
Yeah. You're called to the bar, as the phrase goes, you're a barrister. Yeah, and then you when you after a certain number of years, 10, 12, well, it's kind of near 15 to 20 years. A lot of people think of what's called taking silk, which is becoming a senior counsel. Yeah, so you start as a junior counsel, and then if you think you're up to it, you move to become a senior counsel.
Okay, so John O'Donnell as barrister, and I wouldn't have called you junior barrister, just barrister. But I've addressed you, is that a thing? Like, just Mr. O'Donnell, or would I have addressed you as, you know?
No. John O'Donnell's fine. I mean, like, you know, you would be, because I'm now a senior counsel,
yes.
You get to put in kind of official correspondence about court work and so on. It would be John O'Donnell SC. So, you know, but that's just, it's like a bit like doctor or something.
Yes. Okay. You can choose when and where to use your title. Okay.
Yeah. I certainly wouldn't be using it. So
I can introduce this episode now with that at the start.
I certainly wouldn't be expected to use it.
No, I'm just curious with I love hearing about the sort of the rituals and the etiquette of certain jobs and hierarchies and all of those things that go on. I love that little detail about the devil.
And the other thing is, I mean, there are an awful lot of you in there. Like, the law library is amazing in that it's kind of fractured a little bit since COVID, because people obviously stopped coming in and meeting together. But there's still this idea that we're all in this together. We're all, you know, if there's a meeting, the chairman would address the meeting of the bar as brothers and sisters. We are brother, you know, we're kind of a brothers and sisters. We're a family. If you were referring to an argument that your opposite number made in court, you would say, well, my friend, Miss McKee, may think that, but I don't agree, you know, and it's all very courteous. And
oh, I like that.
It is a little bit, I mean, sometimes it occurs to me that it is not unlike the writing community, in that barristers are quite watchful of how other barristers are doing. And, you know, they would be kind of looking and say, well, how's she getting work from him? Has he, in that case, he doesn't seem to be good. And look, we all know that in the writing community, there are people who are keeping a beady eye on how others are doing and who they're being published by and what they're being paid and so on. But they do turn out to support each other.
Yes.
Writers do turn up to support each other, and so do the bar.
Oh, I love that analogy.
Mm.
I love that. Mm. Yes.
But you can ask other barrister writers and they may have a different view. But yes. But it certainly, when I kind of became part of the writing community and you just kind of slide into it, it's not like you join, like paying membership fee, but it certainly occurred to me that there is a similar...
it's like a cordiality mixed with a little dash of sort of watchful jealousy.
Yes, yeah, watchfulness. Yeah. And they're not actually deceiving each other or tricking each other. And the other thing, I suppose, is that barristers, would be, fighting each other hammer and tongs in cases, during the day. And then they might go out and say, okay, the case is over. We'll go and have a drink or whatever, go to dinner or whatever it is. So, there is that clash and then, eat and drink as friends, as I think Shakespeare says in The Taming of the Shrew,
Yeah, like that. Or what was that? Who was it that said was that quote about success? When a fellow writer is successful.
It's Gore Vidal, I think, isn't it? Every time a friend succeeds, a little part of me dies. Yeah. It's wonderful, isn't it?
And I really love that.
There is a soups on a little tiny droplet of that.
Oh, I think
in the Low Library. But generally, by and large, the bar are incredibly supportive.
And of course.
One of the things when you come into the bar as a junior, firstly, we have this convention that you only address other barristers by their first name. You don't even shake hands. And this sounds ridiculous, but that sounds discourteous. It's the direct opposite. The idea, excuse me for mansplaining, but the idea of shaking hands, you shake hand because you show that you have no sword in your hand.
Of course.
And the other person shows they have no sword in their hand. That's why you shake. So you're both declaring that you have no animus towards each other. But that is presumed amongst members of the bar. So we don't need to shake hands because we're presumed to have no animus against each other. So there is a convention that we do not shake hands when we meet.
So you just stand and sort of nod at each other and say,
Ruth, you could be, you could have been in the bar for 40 years more than me. I could be starting in my first week and you could be at the bar for 40 years. And I would still say, hi, Ruth, and you'd say, hi, John, because... That's the convention, that we are all brothers and sisters at the bar together.
Oh, I love that. So, John, what were you reading around then? What fiction were you reading as a young barrister?
I mean, I'm trying to think of some of the books, that I remember. There's one book that I still remember, and it is about a lawyer, but it's about the impact of what happens... when a lawyer comes to town. It's a book called The Sweet Hereafter by Russell Banks, I think it's by. And it's a book, what happens in it is there is a school bus which crashes in Canada, I think, in the little village in Canada. And the lawyer comes to town because there's going to be litigation, because there's going to be a claim, because a number of the people in the bus are killed or injured. And look, it's obviously tragic. It's about school kids being killed or injured. But when he comes to town, we get his story as well, the lawyer's story and, his family's situation. But also the secrets in the town start to become apparent. The various backstories of some of the characters become apparent. The various enmities, the various, resentments... And the way it's told, it is wonderful. It's a really wonderful book. Adam Egoyan, who you may have heard of, a director, made a movie of it, starring Sarah Polley, who is also a movie director herself. She made Come Away With Her, I think it's the one about dementia with Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland. But anyway, that's a kind of a book that I remember from my time. I don't know when I first read that. But that's a book I remember from my time. But I would have read all the, growing up, I would have read the Roddy Doyle books. Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, was one that I, really remember really enjoying. And I loved Roddy Doyle. I remember my wife's best friend is a woman called Maria Doyle Kennedy, and she was in The Commitments. So we went to see the movie The Commitments, yeah. And, you know, so we read all The Commitments and The Snapper and The Van, and I loved all those. Then people were, you know, I read Richard Ford, Independence Day, the sports writer. You know, I remember those. So yeah, they're kind of some of the highlights of the books I remember. I was just thinking in college, I didn't really read that much, but I do remember one. I still remember one book. It wasn't so much a book; it's a play. I joined UCD Drama Circle, and there's a play called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. But again, we were talking earlier about kind of wordplay and word association and where do words come from and so on. And that was, I had never read Tom Stoppard before. And that was a brilliant introduction to me into how you can play with words, where words might come from, what they mean, what you can do with them. And I know it's like that book is, that play is might be nearly 60 years old now. But again, you know, that really, you know, it's still, when I see it or read it, I really enjoy it.
And did you read it first, John, or did you go and see?
No, I was in it.
You were in it?
Yeah.
I misunderstood. Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow.
I joined Dramsoc and we did a couple of shows. In fact, we did, we at a time when it was banned, we did a stage version of A Clockwork Orange. Now, it wasn't a very good one, but we did do it and we packed out because the movie was banned.
Of course.
In the 70s. And... But we did this and yeah, it was fun.
So you could have gone down this. You could have gone down the acting.
I wasn't good enough, and I don't know if I'd have had the patience. And again, you know, I have a couple of friends who are actors, and this thing of living on your nerves and waiting for the next part. And as they, I think it is a little bit like the bar, and you know when they have, as you know, actors have this wonderful word for when they're not working, they're resting. and so, you know, I certainly appreciate the concept of resting.
Wow, there are loads of parallels there, and I'm thinking, so you know, you were inhabiting a role, and then even with you,
yeah, and there's all that, and kind of. Yeah, as I say, you know, developing empathy is important.
Of course, it seems to be a very, that's a big vein right through everything that you've done, isn't it? And so what about, is there a book that was around for you, John, at a beautiful time in your life or a difficult time in your life, or just a book that you know, sometimes if you, like for me, I remember reading something when I had morning sickness. I'll never forget that book. But is there a book like that that just marked a moment in your life?
I think, like, you were asking me what about writing, and like, in the 80s, I wrote almost nothing. I wrote almost nothing for 10 years. And in 1990, a couple of things happened. The first thing is I got married. Obviously that was a major moment, and we're still together. 36. She's still there. She hasn't got parole or any early release or anything like that. So, the second thing was that I had always admired Paul Durkin, and I remember seeing a poem of his when I was in school. Could see a poem written by somebody who was actually alive and living in Dublin. Because all the rest of the poetry was by people who were dead, except I think Austin Clark. But in the spring of 1990, the Trinity had this, their writer in residence, and they announced that it was Paul Durkin, and they said, we're going to have an open competition for 12 people to come in and be part of his series of workshops for 10 weeks or something like that. I can't, 6-10 weeks. So I applied for that and I got it. And I still remember I had a voice, you know, there was, before we had voicemail on our phones, I had an answering machine to try and again create this idea of being busy and professional and so on. And to come home and hear Paul Durkin's voice, and I don't know whether he was joking or whether it was serious, but he said, John, this is Paul Durkin. I don't think your answering machine is working. And that was a wonderful opening line. And I think he may have been, the more I think of it, the more he's mischievous, you know, or he was mischievous. So I think he might have been joking. Anyway, so I went back in to that, once I said, I'll always want to do this and I'll never forgive myself if I don't do it. And that's when I started to write again. And I never stopped writing. And so what I remember are two things. Firstly, he introduced us to a writer I had never heard of called Raymond Carver. And, you know, so you have things like, I remember A New Path to the Waterfall, which was his final collection. I think he was dying or had just died. And then all those short stories, like What Do We Talk About When We Talk About Love, all those. So I, again, you know, I would associate them with that 1990, that period when I suddenly, you know, the privilege of being taught by Paul Durkin in a class, but also him bringing us these books and these writers that I had never heard of. And then the other thing I remember is it was just around the time, shortly after that, that his own collection called Daddy Daddy came out, which is all about his relationship with his father. And Paul Durkin's father was a barrister and later became a judge. So,
yeah, that's some circle.
Isn't it interesting? Yeah, that is his brother, Paul's brother, is a solicitor. So, it's fascinating, isn't it?
And so that was that whole period, and you got married. You had this sort of explosion then it's a bit dramatic, but that was a kind of a real blossoming period for you then of writing, of, you know, love, of everything sort of just.
Sure. And it's, you know, it's one of the big years, and, you know, people have big years in their lives, I think. And 1990 was certainly one of mine. And also to remember, it was year of Italia 90.
Okay, you got that one in there. I was going to ask you if you mentioned earlier, but you know, you said you read all the Paddy Clark books and everything like that, but
Ronnie Doyle, yeah.
Sorry.
Sure.
So, do you know what? That's another one of my, what's the word? It's not a spoonerism, but I have there's certain names that I get mixed up all the time. Donal Ryan is one. Donal Ryan and my boss, who's called Ronan Colgan. So I have Ronan and Donal, which I mix up all the time. So I have Ronald and I have Ronal and Donald. And actually, when I was talking to Donal Ryan, I had written his name down so many times. Just as I was talking to him, I kept writing the word Donal Ryan down. Mm. And Declan. Mm. Declan is another one. So apologies for that.
I mean, this happens. There's a colleague of ours called, very, very nice man, called Ronan Dolan.
Oh,
but
God.
He's called Roland, you know, I mean, you can imagine.
No. Anyway, apologies for that. What I was trying to get at was, are you a rereader and do you go back to any books?
Almost never. I mean, I reread, what I reread all the time are poetry, and to a lesser extent, but I still do reread quite a few short stories. But I almost never reread novels, virtually never. Not quite sure why that is, but I suppose there's a sense of, firstly, there are so many books out there that you want to read, and some of them, you know, some novels, they don't necessarily repay rereading. I mean, I suppose if you look at, I think there's a book, like if you think of a book like Small Things Like These, which is more like a long short story than a novella, that's something that I now kind of read every Christmas. You know, I think it's just kind of one of those books that you can read, and it's not too time consuming to do it.
Yes.
You don't feel that you're losing out on reading other books, but generally poems, yes, short stories, yes, novels, no.
So what poets or poems would you go back to? Do you have a particular, or is it just, you know, this, it's instinctive, it's the mood, it's the time.
No. I mean, like, obviously, look, I would have been a huge fan of Seamus Heaney and Evan Boland and Paul Durkin, as I say. And of course, they're all gone, which is very sad. But there's this book, I mean, I was thinking about wondering this. I don't know if you've ever come across this book called Lifelines. And this is a book that Niall McMonagall put together. He, to raise money for Concern with the students that he was teaching in Wesley. He's now retired. But what they did was they wrote to various famous people, got them to choose their favourite poem, and got them to say a few words about the poem. And then they put it into book and sold it, and the proceeds went to Concern.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are three of them. This is the kind of the omnibus of the three of them. But what's brilliant about that is, firstly, you get a really wide range of poems. They're kind of, some of them are Irish, some of them are English, but they can be, you know, translations and so on. Secondly, you get an insight into the author or the person who's chosen them, the personality or famous person, say, who's chosen you, they tell you why they chose them. You say, oh, that's interesting, I never thought of that. Or you might say, well, no, that's completely wrong, didn't make any sense. But either way, it does give you another way of looking at a poem that you might not have thought of, or that you might have thought of, but that you weren't able to articulate as well as this person had articulated it. So that would be a book that I would go back to, you know, beautiful, again and again. And, you know, because there's so much in it, you can dip in.
Keep going to the well.
You're not committed to reading it from cover to cover. So it's not like, oh my God, you know, the weight on your shoulders. Likewise, with the short stories, and this, I mean, this sounds kind of, you know, maybe ridiculous, but I still remember some of the short stories I read in school in that junior cert or inter-cert as it was then, short story selection. And, you know, there are things like, I've mentioned this before, I think, but Mary Lavin's story, The Widow's Son. That's a story I remember reading in school and the top of my head nearly lifting off, you know, that she puts two endings to the story.
Oh, wow. I don't know this story.
It's a story about a widow has a son and the son is involved in a bicycle accident. And she says, well, now, this is what happens if he dies, and this is what happens if he lives. And like most of us who are writing short stories can only think of one ending.
Yeah.
And she thinks of two, both very good ones, and puts them both in and says, okay, what do you think? You know, so, I mean, it's like I would read, and some of the other stories, and it's not, I'm not just doing it for nostalgia. There's a little bit of that, but I mean, it's not just that. I'm also going back and saying, it's interesting that these stories were chosen for a curriculum to give kids, yes, an insight. And the other thing is, I am interested in narrators, particularly youthful narrators, not children, not very small children, but youthful narrators. Some people hate them. I know some, you know, I remember one of my teachers hated child narrators, couldn't bear them. There's a line from one of Louise Gluck's poems, "We look at the world once in childhood, the rest is memory," and there's a lot to be said for that.
Oh, yeah, I'm totally with you on Louise Gluck. And actually, you've a fair few young narrators or young perspectives in your stories.
Sure,
also.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was reading a piece that you wrote where you talk about writing as kind of like holding a rod in a river, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I really love that. You're just sort of waiting for this. And you made a joke about everyone being downstream from Bob Dylan.
That's Arlo Guthrie said that. He said, if you're going fishing for songs, you want to make sure that you're upstream from Bob Dylan because all the good fish will be gone.
I really love that.
Your line cuts in. So, I mean, that's true.
But I wanted to ask you then about poetry and short stories because you write both. And I'm not going to ask the obvious one, but do you find that there are periods of time or periods of your life where you're in one pool or the other? Do you know what I mean?
I would usually have a bit of both going on. You know, I would have something going on. Like this morning, for example, I was working on, you know, a poem, whereas last week I was working on a short story. This week I worked on another poem yesterday and the day before. So I would usually have a couple of things going on at any one time. I don't know how they choose the form they do, but I don't choose it. I think Paul Muldoon has this line that a poem comes through you. It's not, you don't write it, it comes through you. And obviously you have to get it right, but it comes to you or through you. And to that extent, therefore, I know, you know, if I know that this is a good time to look at this poem, or if I'm midway through a draft of a short story, said actually you need to just put that away for something else. But rather than do nothing, I will then work on some, you know, a poem that I've halfway through or something like that. So you can't be doing nothing.
I did love that description, though. Like, well, to start with, you can't really say where things come from. You can't really say how you put, you know, it's just impossible to talk about. But I did like how you described the sort of anticipatory feeling, that sort of weird, not excitement quite, but that sort of just that. And I think a lot of writers,
it's not far off. It's a kind of almost a tremor. Yeah, I mean, it's that sounds, makes it sound very, you know, ridiculous. But I mean, there is something. Whoa! And you just feel a kind of a little kind of surge of electricity almost through. Yeah.
Yes, and then you think you sort of, and then if it's gone quiet for a while, you think, oh well, you know, it's never.
What you can do is go back. I mean, firstly, like, you know. I mean, Paul Durkin, when we were in his classes, was telling us, you know, keep notebooks. And he had hundreds of notebooks. And certainly, you don't have to keep a notebook, but you can keep notes on your phone.
Yes.
But provided you write stuff down. And so you go back to those notes. I mean, if you can't think of anything, if you just are completely dead, you can go back and look at something that you've already been working on. Or you can go back and look at your notes and say, oh, is there anything here that's of interest? Why did I find that interesting? Why did I find that remark or that quote or that description interesting?
Yes, that's all the sort of workaday stuff that you can do while the other stuff's quieter. It's true. It's true.
It's just giving yourself something to do, yeah.
And in that spirit, then, if you had to choose, it's a horrible question, if you had to choose one story or one poem from everything that you have written, published or unpublished, to save over all the rest of them, could you choose one?
I think, I mean, I've written two books of short stories now, but I think the story that I closest to my heart is Mr. Who. I remember so much about writing it. I wrote some of it during lockdown, and I remember reading it to my kids because it's about a kid, and you know, I needed them to make sure that I hadn't dropped the ball in any way. So I think that's the story that I would feel closest to at the moment. Now, hopefully with the next collection, there'll be another one that I would feel close to as well. But for the present, answering it as of now, in June of 2026, with a new book out, I certainly remember working really, really, really hard on it. I'm not looking for plaudits or credit. I'm just saying that I did. I did work very hard on it.
It's a stunning story. So we're definitely going to save that. And we're going to get to a reading in just a second. You're going to read to us possibly from that story?
I'll read a paragraph. Yeah, sure.
But before we do, just two sort of mischievous questions. Well, one mischievous question is, is there a book or books that you would leave in your burning house to burn?
There are. I don't want to be throwing shade on other writers. I don't think that's, you know, my job. And there's certainly an issue as to when do you stop reading a book that isn't doing it for you. I mean, I would try, because I'm a well-brought-up Catholic boy, I would try and give them at least 100 pages. I know that there are some people who say 10 is plenty. Some would say 50. Some would say 3. But the idea that I would set one on fire or allow one to be set on fire, I just find a bit strange. In the same way as kind of they say that to a sailor, every ship, every boat has something of beauty about it, even though it's, you know, not a particularly elegant book ship. Well, I'd feel the same way about a book. I wouldn't. And we had this experience, sorry, Ruth, I should say, when we were cleared out my father's house after he died, like, he had hundreds and hundreds of books and we could not get rid of them. Like, we obviously took some in our various homes and stored as many as we can. But in the end, we were left and we asked people to take them away. We delivered some of them to people who said they'd take them. But in the end, we had about 200 or 300 of them sitting in a skip. And we asked the charity shops, they said no, not interested. And it was awful. You know, oh. It really was awful. Now, most of them were paperbacks. You can, you know, they're not irreplaceable, but
no, that's not the point though. Yeah, that's
it was quite distressing to do it. So no, I don't think I could set fire to or allow another writer's book to burn.
Okay, hearing you loud and clear. And then is there something that is not a beloved animal, obviously not a human, but something that is not a book that you would save?
Well, it's not a book, but it's not unrelated to a book. I suppose the poet that I would feel that I would most admire throughout my kind of life as a writer would have been Seamus Heaney, was and is Seamus Heaney. And I was not a close friend of his at all, but I did know him a little bit. And I one time asked him, would he do me a real, real favour? And would he write out a handwritten version of what I think is my favourite poem by him and one of the best poems in Ireland called Postscript. So he did. And I have that on the wall. And I'd probably try and tuck that under my shirt as I was running out of the door with the flames billowing. So, you know, we're assuming that all the humans and the dog are out already out.
Yeah, so. That is beautiful. What a beautiful, beautiful thing to have. Yeah.
I mean, it means an awful lot to me. Yeah.
John, we're going to hear a little bit from this superb collection, Mr. Who and Other Stories, published by Dara Press. I finished this book yesterday. I finished the stories yesterday, and I just found them so, like, it doesn't surprise me now, having had our chat about your experience as a barrister and throughout your life, your kind of mining of empathy and also the kind of distance that you might have, because there is a balance of that to me. It's really, I don't even know what the word is. I feel like I'm both inside what's happening, but also observing at the same time, which is really lovely.
That's the idea.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And there's also, and I love, for some of them anyway, there is a couple of little penny drops, which I really like in a story. You know, the penny drops and then another penny drops. Bum, bum. I really like that sort of surprise or bumpiness at the end. Not bumpiness, but that lovely little aftertaste or something. And then there's some of them are so different as well. You know, they're, and I also love how you write about marriage.
Yeah, I mean, it is fiction, Ruth. Yeah.
I know.
To be clear, right? This is not the first person to have raised this. How did you, what kind of level of research did you have to do?
But really, there was one, hang on a second. I underlined this. And writing about people who are not in the first flush of youth either. So one of the characters here is 59. I love this. I was like, when you're young, you think the future will never come. But when you're old, you know, the past will never disappear.
That's true. But I mean, I can only write that now being 59 plus, plus, plus. But it is true. Firstly, thank you to Burning Books and to the Arts Council for funding Burning Books. And congratulations on your own book, Wild Iris, and it was a wonderful launch, and I'm sure the book will do very well, and I saw a fabulous review of it in the Irish Times. What I'm going to do is I'll read a paragraph from Mr. Who, just to explain by way of the background. The narrator is a young boy called Bird. His name's Robert, but he's nicknamed Bird because he is fascinated by birds. But he has never actually seen a bird. For some reason, there are no birds. There aren't even trees in the kind of fairly grim estate where he lives. So he has two pals, Yaz and Scar. And Yaz says, hold on, Bird, if you give me money, I'll show you where you can see a real bird. So this is where this happens. Okay, so I'll read that. We stood outside the last garage on the lane. The door was covered in bright, foamy graffiti. Ma'am says it's called Lockup Lane because everyone who has one is in prison. Moolah first, Bird, said Yaz, holding out his hand. I gave him the tenner from Ma'am's purse. Yaz fiddled with the padlock, slid the door up, and we stepped in. So much stuff. A pair of boxing gloves, a busted sofa, a crossbow, a brassy tuba, picture frames with no pictures in them. Who owns all this? Asked Gar. Yaz answered, but we couldn't hear him properly. Mr. Who? Said Scar. And that's when I saw him. He was perched on a high shelf, a tawny rage of feathers glaring down at us from inside his world of glass. The neat, tucked beak, ears like horns, his eyes blazing blood orange, and the terrible curved talons that could pierce a rabbit's flesh, that could rip the heart out of a young lamb. Straight away, I knew that I would never see anything more beautiful or more deadly. I lifted him down carefully and brushed the dust off his glass dome. "I'll look after you now, Mr. Who," I said. I said it very quietly, so that only he and I could hear.
You've been listening to John O'Donnell, whose latest collection, Mr. Who and Other Stories, is out now with Dara Press. See you all next time.